The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Desiree Shell, and today we're going to be talking about the history and future of research into extrasensory perception. Later on in the show, we'll be joined by Ricardo Chavarriaga-Lozano to hear about some of the recent experiments that have produced an ability that some people are calling telepathy in rats. But let's start out with our own species. I'm here with Brian Clegg. Brian has a degree in natural science from Cambridge and a master's in operations research. And he now specializes in science writing, having written for a variety of publications from the Wall Street Journal to Playboy, and he's written 18 popular science books, including In-Flight Science, How to Build a Time Machine, Dice World, and he's here today to talk about his most recent one, Extrasensory. Good to have you here, Brian.
Hi.
So why write a book about extrasensory abilities if the vast majority of scientists think that there's no evidence to support it?
I think it's two reasons. One is, particularly when I was younger, I was just fascinated by the concept of things like telepathy, the possibility of it being the case. So it was really just a sort of inbuilt interest. There's something, all these kind of paranormal things just have an interest in themselves, I think. And the other thing is, I think sometimes in science, it's a bit easy to be dismissive of things without necessarily thinking through everything that's involved. I mean, it's notable that when Einstein first came up with relativity and aspects of quantum theory, and they put him forward for a society in Germany, some scientific society, they basically said, we'll put him forward despite the fact he's come up with these weird ideas. You know, that sometimes the scientific establishment can be a little quick to put things down.
Well, isn't that the name of the game, though, requiring evidence before you believe in something?
It is, absolutely, but you do have to at least look for evidence and look at the evidence. So what I've tried to do in this book is have a totally balanced view, you know, to come at it totally openly, not wide-eyed and accepting everything, but equally not prepared to dismiss things just because it sounds weird.
Well, that is not the only thing that sounds weird. Something like string theory, you know, it's still not fully embraced as a discipline, mostly because people like me have absolutely no idea what string theorists are talking about, and many scientists kind of roll their eyes at it. But mostly, I guess, because there seems to be no way to test it. But that is still considered science. So what makes these two topics different?
It's really difficult to say. I focus in the book particularly on what I'd call the paranormal rather than the supernatural. So things that are outside our normal sensory and communication type abilities. So things like telepathy, remote viewing, things of that type, but not things that wouldn't have any possible scientific explanation. I think that's where you possibly have to draw the line between things that are totally outside of nature, where you just can't apply science. So I guess religion's one obvious example of that, compared with things that actually we're saying are within nature and we want to find out whether or not it's true.
Well, in the book, you do write that the idea of extrasensory abilities isn't really that far-fetched, because we do actually have senses beyond the standard five, do we not?
That's right. Yeah, the five that we get taught at school is, frankly, almost a myth, you could say. It's certainly a very small subset of the senses we have. And I guess one obvious one is if you just imagine you close your eyes and somebody comes close to you with a hot iron and brings it close to your arm. You know it's there. You can feel it. But which of your traditional five senses are you feeling it with? It's not touching you. You're not tasting it. You're not hearing it. You're not seeing it. The fact is you're sensing infrared. You're sensing heat. And it is an extra sense. And there are several others out there. So we tend to be a bit prescriptive when we just think of five senses.
So let's leave any evidence behind for a moment and just talk about the mechanisms by which extrasensory abilities could work. So you say that telepathy is actually the easiest to fit in with a scientific viewpoint of the world?
Just in the sense that telepathy doesn't involve huge amounts of energy being flung around, because, you know, as soon as you start to try, say, move things with your brain, you're having to think about quite a lot of energy being involved to do the movement. And it doesn't involve having to go from something like sight to something hitting your brain. So, you know, worrying about how could you see something remotely because there's no eye there, nothing to focus what you're looking at. With telepathy, it's just a matter of information communication. So it's a relatively simple concept. And then you have to look at, are there alternative ways to get information from one brain to another? And I guess the simplest possibility would be if it was some form of electromagnetism. So it's just like radio, really. But as far as we can tell, nobody's ever detected this. Yes, there are electromagnetic emissions from the brain, but they're very short range, very low power. So it seems fairly unlikely that's the possibility. But there are other things we can look at. And the Nobel Prize winning physicist, Brian Josephson, has suggested that one possibility is that quantum entanglement is involved, which is this idea that quantum particles can be linked together at any distance and interact with each other. And it's actually quite difficult to come up with a mechanism that would use quantum entanglement. But I think you do have to certainly be a little open-minded and say there may possibly be some way of doing this.
Well, and then, you know, you mentioned telekinesis. So if there was such a thing, how might it be possible?
When you come to telekinesis, it is certainly getting a lot harder. You've got to think, you know, when you push something, you've got all the good Newton's laws stuff happening. So, for instance, you expect it to push back on you. But if it's some sort of mental power, where's the pushback coming from, where it's going to? And actually, I find it very difficult to come up with a sensible explanation for telekinesis. The other problem is that a lot of the experiments involving telekinesis involve doing something much more complicated than you think might be possible. So a very, very common test is to try to make a dice, or a pair of dice or a die, come up with a particular value. And the problem with that is, you know, if you think of a block of wood spinning around, you've got to make it land on a particular face. How would you do that? You know, even with your fingers, you can't make a dice arrive at a particular value. So how are you going to do it with your mind? So I have to say, that's one of the more doubtful ones for me as to finding any practical way of doing it.
And then, of course, the other extrasensory abilities become even less plausible, like precognition.
Well, the difficulty, obviously, with precognition is just the getting through time aspect. In some ways, it has more potential than telekinesis, just because there are at least theoretical mechanisms that do allow things to travel backwards in time. They're quite messy, and they certainly have never been proved. But one example is there's something called advanced waves, which came out of the early understanding of electromagnetism, that says in principle, when a photon of light sets off from A to B, there is actually one traveling backwards in time coming from B to A at the same time that you can't detect. Now, if that were true, and we have as yet no way of proving whether or not that's true, but it sort of falls out of the math, then you have to say to yourself, could that be used? Is there any way that could be used? But frankly, of course, it is pretty unlikely. And the other thing is that where we have some examples from things like telepathy that could well be a good example of it happening, it's much harder to find a practical example of precognition. Something I don't mention hugely in the book that does interest me is how little, though, we hear about postcognition. You think there might be a little bit more about that, because at least then you don't have to go backwards in time.
What is postcognition?
Basically, being aware of something that has happened after it's happened, but without having any contact.
I have actually never heard that term. Interesting.
No, I may have made it up. I don't know. but all I'm saying is it's interesting that nobody really thinks of that. I mean, yes, some of the other extrasensory perception concepts would allow you to do that. So in principle, remote viewing would allow you to do that,
right,
if you were thinking about it at the time. But I'm thinking rather something that happened yesterday. So it's afterwards. It has actually happened. Why don't we have people saying, I can see what happened yesterday? Because that would be, in principle, easier to do.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm here with Brian Clegg, author of Extrasensory, The Science and Pseudoscience of Telepathy and Other Powers of the Mind. Okay, so some extrasensory abilities would theoretically at least be possible without changing the laws of physics. So back to evidence. People have been trying to provide proof for things like telepathy and telekinesis for years. How far back does that go?
Well, there certainly have been some degrees of controlled experiments going back to the 1880s. There were some quite impressive demonstrations of telepathy back in the 1880s by a couple of guys called Blackburn and Smith. And it was quite interesting because they were the earliest example, I think, we have pretty well of a proved fraud. And one thing you come across again and again, sadly, in tests for psi abilities is that some people will try to cheat. And what they did was one of these guys was basically blindfolded, covered in a carpet, actually, I think, but covered up and generally isolated from the other, and didn't manage then to receive some information. And the interesting thing was these were ordinary working guys. They weren't particularly educated, and they were taking on professors who were fooled by them. And they said that basically the reason they did it was primarily to see if they can get one over on these intellectuals, you know, to show them they didn't know everything about the world. But it was a total fraud, quite cleverly done, but it was a fraud. So that's the 1880s. The early attempts really were fairly loose. There wasn't a lot of science involved, and it probably wasn't until the 1930s when Rhine started working in the US that we saw a real attempt to be scientific.
Well, and his are some of the most well-known experiments. So what was he working on?
Rhine was originally a botanist. I mean, he was a scientist. You know, he wasn't just somebody coming in randomly with an interest in it. But he and his wife developed an interest in the whole extrasensory business. And he spent the rest of his working life working on this. And the interesting thing really there is that he really did attempt to make it systematic and scientific. The only problem is he didn't do it very well, I think it's fair to say. When we look back now, his controls were pretty poor. Very often he would do things in a way it was really quite easy to cheat. And I say, unfortunately, there is good evidence a fair number of people will cheat given the opportunity. And the other thing is that what he really introduced in a big way and has been a nightmare for the whole field ever since is the use of statistics. So basically not saying, say you're doing telepathy, it's only worked if you communicate a specific message, but rather are you statistically guessing more things right than you should do and using that as a measure. And the trouble is, as soon as you start using statistics to measure how well somebody's doing, you've got to be really good at that mathematics. And frankly, he wasn't.
So maybe walk me through sort of what his experiments looked like.
Well, I think a typical one would be he was using Zener cards. In fact, a guy called Zener was his assistant, which are these cards that have the five patterns on. You've probably seen them. They use them in Ghostbusters, for instance. But so they have things like wavy lines, sort of a square, a star, five basic symbols. The idea being that these are things that, you know, would be reasonably easy to transmit and don't have any associations. He did actually start off with ordinary playing cards, but they tried to make it more controlled by using these Zener cards. And a typical session might be that he would sit across a table from the person who's trying to receive his thoughts, and he would pick a card off the pack, look at it, stare at it, put it down. The other person would jot down what they thought it was, and they go through a pack of 25 and then see how many hits they got. And the thing he introduced here particularly was repetition, that he did this over and over again for thousands of trials to get an awful lot of numbers. But I said the only danger with statistics is you can get almost too impressed by the numbers. You can say, oh, we got these numbers that prove statistically that the chances of this happening accidentally are sort of billions and billions to one against. But if you get if you handle those numbers wrong, if you handle the way you're doing it wrong, then you can get in a real mess.
Well, and you mentioned that that there was a statistics issue, but there were several other design flaws, were there not?
There were, yes. I mean, one of his more impressive feats involved his sort of star telepathist, somebody called Hubert Pierce. And he was sent to a different building. So he was maybe 100 yards away or more. because there was a lot of concern that was the earlier tests, as I say, they were literally done across the table, or in some cases, literally sitting in a car with one of them in one seat, one in the other, literally just next to each other. So the chances for cheating there were really very high. But for this test, Pierce was sent to a different building and still managed to hit well over the five you would expect to get. So with 25 cards in a pack, you would expect to guess about five purely by accident and get them right. He was getting 9, 10 right, that kind of number. And somebody looked into the experiments in the 1960s to see if there was any chance for cheating, and asked, you know, a lot more detail, because one of the problems with these kind of experiments, when you see them written up and they look incredibly impressive, is people often miss out details that can give away what went wrong. And one of the details nobody bothered to put down when they wrote up the experiment was that nobody was with Pierce. So basically, he was sent to this other building. They did the test and then went and collected him 20 minutes later. But nobody actually checked that he actually was where he was supposed to be. And what was found out was that the room they were doing the test sending from had a glass light over the door, so a piece of glass over the door. If you went to the door and stood on a chair from the position they had, you could just watch them looking at the cards, note down what they were, and then amble back to the other building in plenty of time to get the answers right.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but wouldn't that entirely invalidate the results of that research?
Unfortunately, yes. This is the problem. As I say, that I think there are two things happening here. One is, all throughout the history of studying these kind of things, scientists have proved they're actually quite easy to fool. You've probably heard of James Randi, who's very much involved in discovering frauds in this kind of area. He always strongly recommends that scientists who want to test this kind of thing get a magician involved to say, what do you need to do to make sure this is properly controlled? Because they understand how to cheat. They're the best at cheating in this kind of thing.
We're actually going to talk a bunch about James Randi. I want to spend a lot of time on him.
Sure.
So I'm wondering, though, now this is an example of research that people point to as being proof that Psi does exist, regardless of the aforementioned design flaws.
Yeah, and unfortunately, because of these two problems, because of the looseness of the controls and some statistical issues, it is actually very difficult to have a lot of faith in them. I actually thought when I started work on this book that Ryan was going to be one of my big positives, that really was some good stuff there. But when you look into the detail, it is decidedly worrying. So we've not only got these sort of poor controls where it's easy to cheat, but also sometimes for certain, Ryan does some very naughty things. One example is he had once somebody get a run of 15 cards in a row right. And what he does is say, this is incredible. This, and gives you this, you know, the chances of this, it's millions and millions to one that this could happen accidentally, that we get this 15 in a row right. But what he doesn't say is that's only true if you look at those specific numbers, but not if you take them in the whole picture of lots of other ones that haven't been like that. It's a bit like saying, you know, it's absolutely amazing that somebody won the lottery. They must have cheated because it's millions and millions of one to one against that anybody would have the right numbers for the lottery. But the fact is, people win lotteries every week because even though it is very unlikely they'll get the right number, there's a lot of it going on. And similarly, there are an awful lot of tests going on. So occasionally, yes, you would get strings in a row, even if somebody was guessing. I really want to stress, you know, I did not come into this wanting to find this to be the case. I really would quite like all this to have been nicely proved, because I think it's fascinating. I wish there were telepathy, but unfortunately, Ryan's experiments, I think, frankly, weren't good enough to prove it either way.
Well, and there actually has been more recent research in that area, and it comes out of Professor Bem's lab.
Yeah, there's been a lot. I mean, there was quite a lot in the 60s and 70s where they did try to improve on the scientific controls. But unfortunately, again, pretty well all the experiments then were flawed in terms of the controls. But Bem, I think, is rather better. We're right up to the 21st century now. And he's been doing work where people sit in front of a screen and, for instance, for this is more for sort of precognition and clairvoyance, so seeing things remotely. You might, for instance, have an image behind one of two curtains on the screen. Now, of course, this is totally artificial. They aren't curtains. It's just a picture of a curtain. And you have to say which one is the picture going to be behind, and then they reveal it. And he has found a very small statistical support for having some kind of precognition and similarly for having some sort of clairvoyance. But there, I don't think the problem is the controls, because this is something really would be quite difficult to cheat at unless Bem himself was cheating, and there's no suggestion that he is. But instead, the problem is we are here dealing with things very much at a statistical level. So he's saying, okay, you should get a 50% right. Actually, people are getting 52.3% right. So very tiny variance, but because it's happening over a lot of tests, then it should be significant. But the problem is, as soon as you are so dependent on statistics, everything has to be right in terms of the way you're doing it. Yeah. And what I'm not convinced about with this experiment is, for instance, that the randomness of the choice has been properly tested and controlled. Because as soon as you start depending on things happening purely randomly, if your random stream isn't really random, people are actually very good at unconsciously picking up any patterns in the stream. It's been actually proved that if you put some patterns into what's supposed to be a random stream without realizing, people do pick up on it. So you've got to be incredibly careful with that kind of thing. And I really wish with this type of testing, people took a step back from this whole use of statistics. I think in some ways it's a bit of a dead end, and they ought to be concentrating more on actually, does information get across? Because frankly, when people, you know, want to know about, say, telepathy, then they're not asking, is there a vague statistical possibility of being slightly different from an average? They're saying, do you get a message across or not?
Right. Well, I do have to mention just a bit of Bem's research.
Sure.
There was a strange effect in one experiment when the participants were shown erotic pictures. I'm sorry, I have to talk about this.
That's right. This is basically one where there were two types of picture. There were ordinary calm pictures, and there were erotic pictures, and the erotic ones did seem to generate a slightly bigger effect. So where that it didn't happen with the calm pictures. And the suggestion being that this in some way obviously sort of inspires the brain more, I guess, into more activity.
Was that the rationale? Because that is weird on several levels.
Yeah, I think that's fair. But as I say, even then, we are talking about these very small statistical variations. We're not talking about anything major. We're not talking about people getting a whole string of things right or communicating a word or phrase or anything of that kind. So, yes, it's quite amusing, but... I guess, as I say, the idea is that it's being based on this having more, how can I put it, more sort of arousing the brain's awareness if you have an erotic picture. But I'm not totally convinced it proved a lot.
Indeed. This is Skeptically Speaking, and we'll be back with more of Brian Clegg, author of Extrasensory, after these messages.
Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of fine radio stations. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and I'm joined by Brian Clegg, who's written 18 popular science books, the latest of which is Extrasensory, The Science and Pseudoscience of Telepathy and Other Powers of the Mind. So let's talk about the military, because apparently it is possible to design worse research than Ryan and Bem.
Well, sorry, as far as I'm aware, Bem's research is pretty good. It is literally the statistics and randomness that I'm a little bit worried about there. But as far as the military goes, yeah. I guess the most famous example is the whole staring at goats business that was made into a movie and from a popular book on the subject, but apparently based on truth. It is so bizarre that it's hard to believe it really is truth. But allegedly, there was a guy working for the military called a Major General Albert Stubblebine, who was so convinced of his ability to control things mentally that he had a habit of trying to walk through the wall of his office because he was convinced he could mentally readjust the molecules in the wall, bearing in mind that most of an atom is empty space and could just walk straight through it. So you would occasionally get these crashes happening from his office as he attempted to hurtle through the wall. And that sadly seems to have been about the level of most of the military efforts. A lot that was done seemed to be based on basically go out, find anything new age that's going on and go and see it, try it, see if you can make it work, rather than any real organized scientific approach. I guess the closest they came to taking a scientific approach seems to have been in the remote viewing. Obviously, remote viewing would be incredibly valuable. So the idea being that from your desk in your military base, you can see into a Russian military base, or you can see what's happening in Syria or whatever, just through the power of the mind. And obviously, if that could work, that would be incredibly valuable. And they did put a lot of effort into that. But unfortunately, they didn't get a huge number of very good results out of that. One of the best remote viewers, a guy called Ingo Swann, famously, to prove how good he was at this, decided he would remote view Jupiter before the Pioneer 10 probe got out there and could actually confirm what the details were. And it was really quite a sad catalogue of science fiction imagination that he came up with that unfortunately missed the mark on practically everything that wasn't known already. So frankly, you know, all the evidence on the way they were using remote viewing is that it wasn't delivering an awful lot at all.
Well, some interesting work was actually done in the Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research Lab. What was that?
There were two major efforts between Rhine and the modern studies. One was the work done at SRI, where they studied, amongst others, Uri Geller and did quite a lot of remote viewing work. And the other was at Princeton, where they had the Engineering Anomalies Research, which was basically a way of hiding the fact they were looking at Psi. Because, frankly, you know, if you said that's what you're doing, everybody else who was working at the university would think you were mad. And so they actually had to conceal it to start with. Eventually, they became more open about what they were doing. And they did quite a lot of work on mentally altering things or mentally controlling things. So, for instance, they had a huge, almost like a sort of horizontal pinball machine where balls dropped down over a series of pins, and they had to mentally try to control which way the balls went. And they did a lot of work also with trying to control the outcome of electronic devices. But again, unfortunately, what they were doing was trying for very small statistical variations, which brought in all those problems I've mentioned about randomness. They also made a bizarre claim that what they found was the effect was independent of both location and time. Now, location you can sort of live with, although it's quite difficult to understand how somebody control. The idea is, you know, however far away you are, you can have the same effect. That's often said about psi abilities, but it's hard to understand knowing most of what happens with physical forces. But the independence of time means you have to ask in the end how they knew. You know, if somebody was trying to make a six appear at 3 o'clock this afternoon, how, and it was independent of time, how it wasn't the six that appeared 3 weeks later, it was actually the one they were controlling. As soon as you take away any link in time, you can't prove anything as far as I can see. So that was very strange.
Well, and I sort of feel bad because I find this all very amusing, but it's mainly just because the design flaws are so apparent. So is this field really difficult to design research for? Because I personally would love lots more research in this area.
Yeah, I certainly don't think it's something that we should be abandoning. I'm not convinced at this stage that we can say the whole lot is rubbish. There's nothing to look into. But I guess the things we have to look at is, first of all, making sure it's difficult to cheat. And there, as I say, I would recommend anybody testing this to get a magician in to make sure that they're not missing something obvious, because magicians are very good at misdirection, and that's what cheats do in this kind of thing. The second thing is to say, can we move away from this statistical approach and look for something more concrete? Because, if you're doing telepathy, can we try to commit only accept it if a specific word has been got across or something like that? Because otherwise, I think you're always going to fall down potentially on the statistics. And the third thing is the environment and conditions, because almost all attempts, say, to test telepathy in the lab are in very calm, relaxed environments. I mean, some of the weirdest experiments, something called the Ganzfeld experiment, they even had people with half ping pong balls taped over their eyes and pink light played on them to try to get them into a sort of semi-conscious state to be able to communicate better. And I think that's, or if there is any evidence of something like telepathy, it's the total opposite, that people, if people do communicate through telepathy, it tends to be under stress, under pressure, when something drastic is happening. And I almost think we ought to be taking in the, although in a more friendly way, the sort of nasty things that psychologists have done to people in the past to fool them into thinking something horrible is happening, and you use that as a way of stressing people enough to perhaps be able to get them to communicate telepathically.
And you're talking about things like the Milgram experiment.
I wouldn't go as far as that. The Milgram experiment was basically where people thought they were giving electrical shocks to a test subject and were ordered by somebody in a white coat effectively to give them stronger and stronger shocks to the extent that they should be almost killing them. And they did under that pressure, where it wasn't really happening, it was an actor that was on the other end. I'm not saying going that far, but using a little bit of deception is a very common psychology approach to try to get over people's apprehensions of what's going on. And I think you might have to do that a little bit. So, get the impression that you are saving somebody from something that's risky, or something, some way of putting people under stress in order to get them into the right mental state. I don't think that has been looked into enough.
You're tuned in to Skeptically Speaking, and we're talking about the research around telepathy, telekinesis, and other abilities like that with Brian Clegg, author of Extrasensory. Now, you've mentioned magicians twice, so let's talk a bit about James Randi and his work in this area.
James Randi was a professional magician, is the great Randi, but has dedicated much of his life really to uncovering frauds and investigating psi abilities, everything from telepathy and remote viewing to dowsing for water and all that kind of thing. And he set up this foundation that offers a $1 million prize to anybody who can come up with one of these phenomena in a controlled and testable fashion. Now, I have to say, to be fair, that I sometimes get the impression that he's a little bit smug about what he does, and also that it is really difficult to get anywhere close to that $1 million. It's not made easy, I mean, not surprisingly. But having said that, nobody has ever got close to it. And he is very good at, first of all, duplicating what's done by people who claim that they have special powers of the mind. Now, it's fair to say that just because you can duplicate something doesn't mean that the other person is cheating. But it's certainly, if you can find a nice, simple way of making something happen, then Occam's razor tells us that's more likely to be what's happening than something really weird and strange. So we at least need to take into account, is that happening? And say, if we can get a magician on side to say, this is how I would do that, this is how I'd cheat, this is what to look out for, then it will help scientists not to fall into the sort of traps that their colleagues have done in the past.
And Randi has actually offered his services to researchers in this area to develop proper protocols.
Yes, in fact, there was a fascinating example where he offered his services and they were rejected And so some might say, in a bit of revenge, he got two young performers to apply for the position of the test subject. And not surprisingly, they performed really well in the original tests. And I ought to say, by the way, that this is one of the other failings that many tests have had in the past, is that what they do is they'll start off by testing a lot of people, find the people who do well, and use those as their test subjects. And that's fine, but what you can fall into as a trap is to use the results that you selected them on as part of your final data. So, and you've automatically then just selected some data that's good, and so you've boosted your results artificially, and that's one of the many pitfalls from the mathematical viewpoint that are there. But what Randy did, as I say, was get these guys involved. They did some really quite blatant cheating, which was eventually revealed. And the scientists running the test said, we hadn't put proper controls in at this point because we were just getting familiar with things. And we would have been much stricter later. But you have to think, maybe they should have listened to him in the first place.
So why is it that a magician has a better chance of seeing those design flaws than a scientist?
I think it's just their everyday job is deception and misdirection. What they're doing all the time is making you look the other way, as it were, either literally or metaphorically. And that's what's involved if you want to cheat. If you have this amazing ability to bend spoons, not think of anybody in particular, you have some way of making somebody look the other way while you actually physically bend the spoon, then you're going to have a much better chance of fooling them. And the fact is, magicians are really good at finding ways to make you look the other way while they do something, whether it's sort of take a quick peek at some cards, manipulate something or whatever, so that they have the tricks of the trade. They know the kind of tricks that a fraudster is likely to use, and they can be prepared.
Looking at all the research, and you wrote about so much in your book, and it was lovely, but so looking at all of the research that has been done, what can we conclude about extrasensory abilities?
It's always very difficult to say something is totally impossible, but I do personally think that it's very difficult to see a mechanism for precognition. And we as yet have no really very good examples of that. The trouble with something like precognition is, by the way, that we're always wise after the fact. So if you look at something like the predictions of Nostradamus, nobody's ever used those to actually say this is going to happen in the future. What they do is wait until something's happened. I guess this is my postcognition. Wait until something's happened and then say, oh, look, that was in Nostradamus. But nobody knew it was going to happen from it, so they didn't really predict anything from the future. Precognition, I'm very dubious of. Telekinesis, again, just because of the physical aspect of requiring the energy to make something happen. You know, it's so straightforward. It's got to come from somewhere. The mechanism of getting there is very hard to spot. But I'm more enthusiastic about telepathy, as I say, if we can make it real telepathy, a communication of information, and put people in the right sort of environments where perhaps they're more likely to be have that effect. And it's just possible some aspects of remote viewing, some ways of doing remote viewing, usually where there's somebody else at the other end. So again, it's a sort of telepathy, seem to me well worth testing a bit further and pushing further. But I do think we need to take a step back, involve magicians, and also design experiments in very different ways.
So is there even one example of research that's been done that you would look at and say, that's interesting?
It is difficult. I mean, it has all been interesting at some point. But the trouble is that so often you then find out extra pieces of information that prove that actually it wasn't as good as you thought it was. I do still find, for instance, the Daryl Bem's work, aspects of that, with the computers, more the where they're trying to sort of control something with the mind than the precognition aspects of it, that there may be something that's worth looking further at there. But I do think, in a way, it's something we need to sort of throw up in the air and come at it in a different direction. I can understand why people have said, well, they've tried over and over again with the ways they do it at the moment and really haven't got very far.
So I just want to clarify for the audience, it's not that these abilities aren't real, it's just that at this point, we have effectively no evidence to support the fact that they do exist.
I think it's very likely that precognition is not real. It's very likely that telekinesis is not real. But as I say, I do hold out some hopes for telepathy. Perhaps I'm biased because I did actually once experience what seemed to me like telepathy. But the fact is that as yet, we certainly don't have any good evidence. But I think it's so fascinating, it's so interesting to people that we shouldn't totally dismiss it. We should continue to look into it.
So the answer is, as usual, more science.
I think so.
Brian, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.
You can find a link to Brian Clegg, author of Extrasensory, on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we'll be right back with more after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, it's an hour on robots. We'll speak to John Long, director of the Interdisciplinary Robotics Research Laboratory at Vassar College, about his book Darwin's Devices, What Evolving Robots Can Teach Us About the History of Life and the Future of Technology. And guest host Rochelle Saunders speaks to engineering professor Steve Waslander about the autonomous vehicles of the NASA Sample Return Robot Challenge. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Desiree Schell, here with Ricardo Chavarriaga-Lozano, a senior researcher at École Polytechnique Fédérale de Lausanne. He has a degree in electronics engineering from the Universidad Javeriana in Colombia and a PhD in computational neuroscience from EPFL. His research is focused on robust brain-machine interfaces. Specifically, he's focused on the decoding of brain activity that conveys information about the user's cognitive processes and the use of such signals for human-machine interaction. Welcome to the show, Ricardo.
Thank you. Thanks for having me here.
Now, we're going to talk about the research into animal telepathy, and there have been a couple of studies that have come out recently, or fairly recently. One group wired rat brains together, and more recently, there was one on interspecies telepathy, where they made it possible for a human to mentally control a rat's tail. Now, I know this isn't your research, but can you give us a bit of an overview of some of that work?
Okay, so probably we should start from the actual beginning of these works. There were several groups in research groups in the world, including ours, have been trying to study how the activity of the brain is linked to the motor actions we make, and how, on the other hand, we perceive the world, and these perceptions get translated into some signals that the brain can process. So these are the two parts that will later on be used to these works that have been branded as telepathy. But an important thing to understand is that in neither of these works, the information that was transferred was conveying the same information that was originally perceived by the sender, meaning that in one case, they were trying to send information to a rat how to press a given lever, but this was not exactly the same type of information that rat would have used if it were alone to solve that task. And in the same way, in the interspecies case, where they have brain activity measured in the scalp of a human subject, then they use that to decode a two-class problem, A or B. And then once they did this decoding, they sent this bit of information to make the rat in the other end to move their tail. But again, this is not the type of information the rat would have normally used to move that tail. So in brief, there is not a telepathy in terms of sending a specific message and, say, ingrain it into the receiving brain, which is taking the coding on one side and transfer in an abstract way in order to obtain an effect on the receiving side. I don't know if that was entirely clear.
It was, but if I can paraphrase, this was not actually telepathy, billed by various hyperbolic media outlets.
Yeah, so. In short, I cannot use this system to tell someone else what did I have for breakfast.
Well, now, but it's still interesting research regardless. So how was that done? How did that process work?
Okay, so these two processes are taking root on this rather young field of brain-machine interfaces. So the deal with these systems is try to replace the normal output pathway of the brain, which might be injured by a disease or by an accident, and try to replace that, the way our brain communicates to our body, using a external device. So in short, we try to study the activity of the brain when we try to perform a given task. We decode that activity, and let's say that this activity is to move my arm in a certain way. So I will try to decode that information and send that to, normally, a robotic prosthetic device. And this prosthetic device will perform that movement. So this is on one side. Then on the other side, when I act in the environment, I will, for instance, move. And this movement will be perceived by my own body, by the proprioception of my own body, and tell that information back to the brain. Or I will touch something, and my senses will tell that I'm touching something soft or something rough. And this information is again sent to the brain back. So we are in another part of the field is trying to study how this information from our senses is encoded in the brain, and then if the nerves that normally carry that information to the brain are not no longer there or have been injured, how can I use a stimulation, external stimulation, directly onto the brain to reproduce those feelings, to reproduce those sensations? So this has been done in several frameworks, and what these two groups did was trying to put these two things together and decoding specific mental tasks. For instance, in the case of the interspecies telepathy, was to looking at some stimulus shown in a computer screen to determine when the person was looking at those stimuli. Based on that, they found out, or they infer, okay, now the person is looking at the screen, and at that moment they sent a pulse that make the rat tails move. So that's the way it works. But again, in the case of the movement of the tail, this was not an information that that could be processed by the rats in a way that was telling, okay, now I should move my tail.
Right.
So it's a sort of an abstract message that went directly into the part of the brain that generates the impulse that moved the tail, but not necessarily an intention to do that movement.
They've linked rats' brains, but they've also linked a human brain with a rat brain. So is one harder than the other?
Well, if you make it in this paradigm, which is sort of conditioning, it will be pretty similar in both cases.
Really?
Yeah, because you're not trying to know exactly what makes the rat's brain move the tail, or what would be the whole process of information processing that leads to this movement. You're all basically tapping into traditional conditioning. We can remember Pavlov's dog. We can train this dog to have a physiological response whenever it was hearing this bell that was linked in the early training to food. So whenever after training the dog is listening the bell, it will start salivating. So it was similar to what was done to the rat. The rat learned that whenever it was receiving a given stimulus, it had to move the tail. But it's not an entirely intention. We're not saying that whatever was decoded in the human brain had a counterpart in the rat's brain. And this is why this... this experiment is telling us a little bit of how can we, for instance, stimulate the rat, but this is something we already knew, or how can we decode information from the human brain, but this is again something that we already knew as well. So these experiments are not really telling us if there is any synergy between the link, or what would be the right signal to convey between the two brains. These are questions that remain unsolved.
Now, you sound nowhere near as excited as the rest of us about this.
Sorry.
No, that's fine. So I'm wondering then, so what does this research mean?
It's a first step towards a better understanding of the whole process. And actually, what makes this incredibly difficult is that the brain itself is a massively interconnected system that is working in dynamics with the environment through the body. So whatever we have from the activity at a given time is the result of the closed interactions, both within the brain and with the environment. So if we really want to go into this, I wouldn't call it telepathy, but into this process of conveying information from one brain to another, or from the brain to a device, we have to understand the closed loop. We have to understand how a given signal generated in a brain can be translated into an action being in the same body or by a prosthetic limb, and how the feelings that are resulting from those actions are sent back into the same brain and influence the new decisions that are taken later on. This is the harder problem. In the previous cases, it was mostly an open loop case. We have one system that was generating a message, was sending it to the other device that simply learned an association. Whenever I receive A, I do something. But there was no information back. There was no way to have this in a dynamic loop, which is the way our brain is normally doing. And once we start tapping into that, we'll fall into the need of understanding how information is actually coded in the brain. And say, if I'm touching something smooth, how this information that is captured by my finger gets translated into the electric impulses and how these are actually interpreted by the brain. And if we do it into different brains, even if it's the same species, the problem is that this coding may change from one person to another, or they will change in terms of what are the actual cells that are interpreting this code. And this is the hard problem. These experiments that have been presented recently are showing us that it is technically possible to have this decoding and to set this information in a rather timely manner for the receiving end to perform a task. But the big question, and what would really make an advance with compared to the things that have already been shown, will to have this in a closed loop. For instance, having someone trying to control a robotic device, or the same, imagine a prosthetic arm, that this prosthetic arm performs a movement, touches something, and this tactile information is sent back to the brain in a way that can be interpreted.
And I assume someone is working on that.
Yeah, definitely, including some of the groups that have published this telepathy-like studies. So there are several groups that have trying to tackle these problems from different aspects. There are very impressive results shown recently from the groups of Andy Schwartz or John Donohue in Pittsburgh and Brown University, respectively, where they were using implanted electrodes on human subjects and decoding the cortical signals to control robotic arms, robotic prostheses, that allow people that had no motor capabilities to perform reaching and grasping tasks. So this is one of the things that have been done. Other people, for instance, Miguel Nicolelis, who have done one of these works, have worked with Joey O'Doherty on sending this tactile information back into the brain, and in experiment with primates, they have shown that we can stimulate the cortex and tell information that is enough to perform some discrimination tasks, to know where the stimulation is done, and having this link to the movements of the finger, as if I were looking for a specific pattern where the surface is rougher than in another. So these are works that have been done in this field, and our lab and others have used similar approaches, but measuring the brain activity from the scalp and try to decode these intentions to move, and then link to the electrical stimulation of the nerves to allow people to use their limbs and to use them to move the limbs as part of a rehabilitation therapy. So it's a quite an active field. Probably the media have been more excited by this telepathy or from this linking to brains somehow than the actual breakthroughs, I would say, if I allow me to be a little bit critical of it. But there is definitely things that have been coming in this field. So it shouldn't be that pessimistic as I sound probably at the beginning.
So then what would the practical application of this be ultimately?
The main application, I would say, or at least historically, the most interesting application have been to restore the ability of moving and sense to some people that have lost it. So some of the audience may have read the book or see the movie The Diving Bell and the Butterfly that describes the life of someone who suffered the locked-in syndrome, or someone who, after a lesion in the brain, was not able to move anything but the eyelid, but could still hear and see people around. So as someone who was locked inside himself and could not move. So one application of these technologies would be to allow this person or these people to use the brain activity to generate signals that are able to perform the movements they would like to do, either through the use of exoskeleton or prosthetic limbs, or to drive a wheelchair, or to communicate using a computer, for instance, that where the typewriting is based on their brain activity. So this is the one of the initial and historically one of the first application that have been conceived for these brain-machine interfaces. Now, other applications have been thought of and are now under study. For instance, in the case of stroke patients, how can this technology be used to help the recovery of people after stroke? So there is the idea is not to control exoskeleton or the prosthetic for the rest of the life, but to have a supporting device that will help them to recover better and faster.
And how far away are we from that?
Well, that's a tricky question, because whatever I say, I will probably miss for either a few years or a few decades. But I think we are getting closer. But as everything in science, there is a lot of uncertainty. We're getting better at knowing what kind of signals can be used, or getting better at knowing how these signals can be sent to a device, and how this device can interact with the human and perform tasks more and more efficiently. And this has been, let's say, the success of the field so far. Then we start now facing the practical problems. Now we are thinking, okay, how these devices can get outside the lab, can be taken by someone and being used for longer periods of time. And that's quite a difficult process, because that requires changes from the technological point of view, changes from the scope of tests that we can do. So now, in order to have a fully reliable system, we have to test it with a larger population. And that always takes time, and that always takes the involvement not only of the research groups, but other parts of the society. For instance, the clinics where this experience will be performed, the patients and group of patients that can tell us what the actual requirements are, and political decisions in terms of who will be responsible for paying for these techniques. So this is a lot of factors that enter into action once we have moved a little bit beyond the proof of concept. So now we are passing through this stage where several groups have shown that we can decode these signals, that these signals can be used for controlling devices, and they have a certain level of reliability that allows them to be used for a given population. Now, how can we take this and make it a product that someone can get for himself or herself and use it for longer periods of time? That will require an undetermined amount of time, because it depends of all these factors that I was mentioning before that are really outside of the researcher's hand.
Well, it may not be telepathy, but this is a remarkable field. So good luck to all of us.
Thank you.
And Ricardo, thanks very much for being here.
Oh, you're welcome.
You can find a link to Ricardo Chavarriaga-Lozano on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. You'll also find links to Twitter, Facebook, and everything else, as well as to iTunes, where you can download past episodes or subscribe to the show. Before we go, I want to tell you about a fabulous opportunity to see some stunning celestial sights and to support science outreach. Atlanta Star Party is an annual charity cocktail party held in memory of Jeff Medcalf, the blue-collar scientist. This year's proceeds go to support CosmoQuest, an organization dedicated to public education and citizen science. Atlanta Star Party 2013 takes place at Emory Math and Science Center on August 28th. The program features live stargazing and presentations by astronomers Phil Plait, Pamela Gay, Nicole Gallucci, and Derek Demeter. If you're in the Atlanta area or you're headed there for this year's DragonCon, pack a nice outfit and head to atlantastarparty.com for tickets and information. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. 'Cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced and distributed by Suburban Panic Media. Our guest coordinators are Rochelle Saunders and Ed Haynes. Our social media manager is Chelsea Butler. Helen Quivillon is our publications coordinator. Ryan Bromsgrove is our production manager and assistant editor. Josh Witten is our researcher. The show is edited by K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by AOK. And I'm your host, Desiree Schell.